thanks to you all for being here on this evening in the middle of the term at a busy time. Let me share my screen.
Yeah.
And begin the slideshow. And I talk about the self about self-knowledge in the flattened mind, which differs a bit from the title that I provided in advance, partly because the more I worked on these lectures, the more thematically unified they became. Very much of the lectures is an application of the views expressed early on of the flattening of the mind or the refusal of levels, as well as the material from lecture 5 on the massively representational mind. So, but the theme is the same, trying to figure out how self-knowledge works in a cognitively scientific, realistic way, in contrast to a tradition in, say, philosophy of mind, where self-knowledge is merely a matter of reflecting on your conscious thoughts. So, reminder, I did argue on the very first lecture for the elimination of the personal level from our philosophy of cognitive science. The contention is that there is no ontologically distinct, epistemically autonomous personal level. Intelligent behavior, including behavior associated with conscious awareness and the first-person perspective, is produced by a system flattened from above, in which states and processes normally associated with the personal level appear alongside, at the same level as, if you want to embrace the levels talk, those normally thought to be at the subpersonal level. Both kinds of states and processes contributing in various combinations to the production of most forms of behavior. And for me, what's especially important about this is not that the states formerly associated with the personal level appear at the same level as the subpersonal states. That's one way to put it. But what I'm really on about is allowing these things to appear together in models. So sometimes these are called mixed models, although again, I'm a little wary of that because that presupposes there are different things being mixed and I'm not so sure how different these things are. Anyway, I think a good way to remind you of the view or convey the view to someone who's just hearing about it for the first time is to show you a picture, a figure that I showed you earlier from a paper by Marco Perugini. And what's important is not that we understand all of the components of this diagram, all parts of this figure. It's just that in the center left, implicit attitude and explicit attitude are two things that seem to be traditionally would be associated with the personal level for explicit attitudes and the subpersonal level for implicit attitudes. Implicit attitudes are subconscious and they're not thought through and they control behavior in a kind of spontaneous way that one can't reflect on. And explicit attitudes are consciously held, explicitly reported beliefs. And here they are right next to each other, helping to explain spontaneous behavior, kind of immediate responses to the environment or time pressure, but also helping to explain deliberative behavior. That's the possibility presented by this model. There was an extra twist that these particular numbers don't reflect a strong interaction, but that's just from one experiment. Some of the other experiments Perugini did showed something more like what you see in this picture. Okay, so we've got a kind of, we might think of it as a practical approach, use whatever is useful in modeling data sets. Don't rule anything out. If you want to include states that we've historically associated with consciousness or the personal level alongside very, what we normally think of as low level mechanistic states like a lateral inhibition mechanism that I showed in yesterday's lecture, then just go ahead and include all of those things in your model. Let your equation have terms for all of them if you're thinking of it in terms of the formal presentation. All right. So what would self-knowledge look like in a cognitive system flattened from above? It's such a different way for many people to think about cognitive architecture, about the kind of structure of the mind. It's worthwhile asking about this very important topic of self-knowledge. And in particular, I'm going to ask about self-knowledge in connection with self-improvement, this particular kind of computational or functional role that self-knowledge plays of giving us tools to improve ourselves. All right, let's ask some very general questions first, get going. What counts as knowledge? Okay. I'll treat self-knowledge as reliable verbal report or other indication of states appearing or processes occurring in whatever components of the flattened architecture count as the self. So we have to figure out what counts as the self, but if we've established that, then any verbal report or other indication of states appearing, processes occurring in that, those elements of the cognitive system, then those will count as self-knowledge. So a reliable report, the fundamental idea here is that reports are data that stand in explanatorily useful statistical relationships to events occurring in the self. But what is the self? We'll talk a lot more about the form of the reports and the kind of statistical relationship. But I want to digress a bit from that topic and make sure we have some fixed notion of the self. It's the one I presented on Tuesday. The self is the relatively integrated, relatively persistent collection of mechanisms that contribute in overlapping subsets to the production of a wide range of forms of intelligent behavior. In Tuesday's lecture, I presented a statistical measure of the clustering of mechanisms according to how likely a given mechanism is to contribute to various forms of intelligent behavior, conditional on the contribution of other mechanisms. Now, I won't repeat any of that today, but the idea is that there's maybe a way to make this idea of a cognitive system precise in a way that's going to include the wide range of kind of mechanisms that we normally think of as contributing to intelligent behavior, visual processing mechanisms and language processing mechanisms and attentional mechanisms and so on. So one thought then is that the self is that entire system. That's the view that I've been promoting. But why not the specifically self-related components only? So an alternative approach is to identify a more limited structure or structures within the cognitive system that plays the distinctive role of the self of, for instance, I think that of is stray. For instance, by fixing and updating doxastic-like commitments, that is forming and revising beliefs, be another way to put that, by maintaining a coherent biography, a narrative about oneself and one's life, by generating explanations of one's actions to each other. The influential philosopher of mind and cognitive science and biology, Dan Dennett, has emphasize this idea that the self is the public relations department, the part of the cognitive system that tells stories to others to sort of make oneself look good, to cover up maybe actions that weren't so well motivated, that might have been selfish or mean, to try to kind of sell these after the fact as not such bad things after all. That's one way to think about this item, generating explanations of one's actions to other. They may be explanations that involve smoothing over rocky incidents or improving one's image in front of others. Producing inner speech. So forget about explanations of one's actions to others, where there's a constant stream for most people, a constant stream of inner speech, the voice in one's head. The distinctive role of the self includes initiating and guiding planning and decision-making, guiding attentive motor control or skill execution. So the thought here is just to start off by generating a list of things that an objector might want to view as the specifically self-related components only. To say, hey, Rob, don't identify the self with the entire cognitive system. Self-knowledge is related to, some kind of who we are, like in some deep and important sense, what makes me the person that I am. And the parts of the cognitive system involved there, you might think are these kinds of things. It might give me my belief in my personal history, and the voice I talk to myself in. And support of this approach, pump some intuitions here. Reliable report on some parts of the cognitive system is much more closely connected to traditional questions about self-knowledge than is reliable report on other parts. Reliable indications of the relative timing of the contributions of syntactic versus semantic analysis to sentence processing might constitute knowledge of the workings of an important part of the cognitive system, but it doesn't seem self-related. It doesn't seem to pertain very much to sort of who I am. Think about the, if you were in attendance of yesterday's lecture, you might think about the lateral inhibition mechanism that I described and showed a diagram of. You might think, well, that's part of my cognitive system, and in that case, part of visual processing, but it's not part of who I am as a kind of as a person. But I want to run through some objections. These elaborate on some things I've said earlier, but I want to really emphasize that this list is going to be long and messy and eventually, ultimately, unprincipled. We'll end up including the entire cognitive system, I think. So any action that relies on information about some subset of local moral norms, including criticizing or condemning others, all those actions all will be included. You want to think about all the mechanisms contributing to that. The extent to which someone is collaborative in conversation or tends to interrupt others, and variations in the context in which they exhibit the two forms of behavior. Why do they do it sometimes and not other times to members of one group but not members of another group? What games a person likes to play and the way in which they play them, with a conservative strategy or a risky strategy. Do they take more chances when they play chess? These are a variety of questions that we might ask when we're inquiring into what someone is like, who they are, what their personality is like. And I run through some of these kind of sort of different possibilities to emphasize how many mechanisms will come into play. Playing games entrains all kinds of logical skills and perceptual skills. Conversation involves a lot of language-specific skills, perhaps, but also broader social skills, if you're talking about conversational tendencies. Any kind of debate about morality or politics, or anytime one criticizes others or condemns others, there's a kind of big aspect of social cognition that involves group expectations and group norms. And you think, boy, if we tried to include all the mechanisms that are at work in all these cases, including all the ones on the earlier slide, it's starting to look like the entire cognitive system is being included. And here's another example that emphasizes language and social cognition and the self. Language use is deeply integrated into much of our self-related behavior, mind wandering, internal monologue, the mental chatter. Socially, language use plays a significant role in the deeply personal matter of giving and accepting of reasons. In anything from political debate to debate about sports teams to arguments with one's spouse. And in such contexts, even cognitive mechanisms to do with the timing of syntactic and semantic analyses might play a significant role in the production of behavior, potentially biasing interpretations of incoming speech or the cognitive search for responses. I don't know that it's very, has been a very influential theory of emotion, but there is one reasonably well-supported theory of emotion that's out there that according to which emotions have a kind of functional role of biasing cognitive search. This makes some sense. But the idea is that many of these self-related, what we think of as maybe importantly self-related factors have subtle computational roles, or may have a computational or functional role we didn't expect, such as guiding search. You might associate emotion, for example, just with a feeling that you have, a feeling sad or feeling joyful. But it may be that in the cognitive system, emotion is playing a role of helping with computation in a certain way. So we want to be open to the possibility that various mechanisms are contributing in ways that don't really fit their label. And it may be that if we go through and analyze any of these things, including giving and accepting reasons, we'll see the wide range of cognitive skills that contribute to any one of these. So further concerns or in summary of what's been said already, autobiographical memory provides the database for much of our self-related cognition. If we have a self-narrative, we have to store that narrative. But what is remembered or reconstructed is affected by one's goals and the extant audience. It shifts. One plausible gloss is that the individual encodes multiple self-models. I have kind of multiple narratives, different ones contributing to different self-related tasks. Each individual self-model contributing differently on different occasions, for example, when speaking to different audiences. So context will activate one of the narratives in favor of others, over others. Two, the reconstructive nature of memory suggests that even with regard to any single self model, its contents vary from one instance of use to another, simply remember different things. I was looking at some experiments recently where people claimed to remember important social events. There was a US spaceship that blew up in, 1985 maybe. Many subjects were asked, where they were when the Challenger, I think it was called, but when it exploded, and what they saw on TV. It was an exploration of what's sometimes called flashbulb memories. Many of the subjects reported things that they weren't in a position to view. Sometimes you could manipulate their reports, say, of important events from their high school years, their secondary school years, by having them interact with their peers. It was a power of suggestion. So sort of false memories were being implanted. I mention these because they're particularly related to your personal narrative and your personal history, like where I was when this momentous event in modern history occurred, what we did in high school. These memories are labeled. They can be changed, they shift, and this is related to the reconstructive nature of memory. Language-based narratives often don't play the appropriate role in planning and the control of behavior. Subject accounts of what they're doing and why they're doing it often don't track what's producing the behavior being reported on. So there's a nice paper by John Bickle from a while back where he says, it's basically criticizing Dennett's view that I described of a kind of narrative as a PR department. He's criticizing maybe this whole idea that the self would be the thing that does the narrating, the thing that is the voice inside one's head. These kind of conscious linguistic experiences or performances don't match up all that well with the parts of the cognitive system that are producing the behavior that are being reported on. Their dissociation, he goes through a lot of double dissociation kind of experiments. And this also pertains to the long history of, in social psychology, of asking people to make introspective reports and seeing them insist on factors that couldn't possibly have affected their behavior. A simple kind of case without all the details, but you give subjects a placebo pill and don't tell them, what the pill, don't tell them that the pill is really a sugar pill. They will often attribute some of their behavior to the pill, which is impossible. The pill is just a sugar pill. So there seems to be a mismatch often between the processes that produce behavior and what we think in linguistic terms about them, what we report about them. Those behaviors and their causes in particular. The systems or subsystems that contribute to self-report typically harness a variety of other resources, including attention, vision, and proprioception. Models of oneself, self-conceptions, autobiographies, as I mentioned, narratives, they contribute to the performance of self-related roles in tandem with various other resources shared to various degrees across various contexts. These concerns challenge the motivation for and likely success of any attempt to identify a well-defined subset of one's cognitive mechanisms or processes as the truly self-related ones, particularly if one accepts the utility of the flattened approach to cognitive modeling. Any sort of motivation to try to carve out just the self may disappear. There's motivation to do that if you think there's a personal level, a domain where the self resides apart from the nitty-gritty details, the mechanisms that produce output. But if you've given up on the personal level and if you're sort of adopted this more liberal approach to modeling and you include explicit beliefs right alongside implicit beliefs and et cetera, then there's less reason, I think, to try to carve out this well-defined subset and identify it as the self. Propositional encoding versus mere information carrying. A necessary condition on self-knowledge might be that vehicles of self-knowledge must encode propositions and that those propositions must be true. Self-knowledge must take the form of true statements about oneself. So I've shifted gears here in the following sense. I've moved from this consideration of what is the self. I've arrived at the conclusion that the self is, in fact, the cognitive system as a whole. So I'm going to stick with that. But what would count as a report of knowledge about that system? What form do knowledge reports take? So we might consider this possibility that a necessary condition on self-knowledge is that we have explicit reports that encode propositions. A more liberal view allows merely information carrying structures to serve as vehicles of self-knowledge. And I will adopt that view and try to explain to you what it is and why we might like it. One should wonder whether the more restrictive view is arbitrary, whether it's too restrictive. Why stick with just these knowledge states? And I can hear the voice of philosophers chiming in saying, well, because that's the nature of knowledge. It's justified true belief. And in order for something to be true, a true belief, it has to be the sort of thing that is truth apt. It has to express a statement or an idea that could be true or false. And that's what a proposition is. But I think the underlying problem I have here is why. I know there's that theory, but why is that the correct account of knowledge in the first place? A correct account of knowledge that we want to import into our discussion of self-knowledge. After all, there are many ways to convey information about the cognitive system. Consider, for example, how readily one performs a physical task, such as climbing stairs. In such cases, one's bodily activity is an indicator of something about oneself. I'll accept a broad range of possible vehicles of self-knowledge, those that are truth apt, like states that express propositions, and otherwise. Note that what I have in mind in these cases, like climbing the stairs, for example, it's not so narrow as procedural knowledge, that is knowing how to perform a given kind of action, such as riding a bicycle. A vehicle could be an accurate propositionally encoded verbal report. That's okay. That's I'm not against that possibility. It could be an inaccurate propositionally encoded report. That's an important case because sometimes the best way to treat a verbal report is as a signal, as a mere kind of signaling of a state that's on the inside. Without necessarily describing it. Any verbal report is in a way a signal of the internal state that produced it. Whether or not the internal state fits the content of what is given in that report. So verbal reports are themselves things like, they can be used as diagnostic indicators. They can be treated as signs that the body gives. in which case maybe their propositional content is not important. But it's okay if when we face cases of procedural knowledge, skilled performance could carry self-knowledge, or could be a vehicle of or manifestation of self-knowledge. But it might be some other physical indication of one's states, as in my example from the previous slide about one's willingness to climb stairs or perform some other kind of action that's physically demanding given one's state, maybe one's state of health. All right. So I indicated a moment ago the importance of the case in which subjects issue verbal reports, and those verbal reports carry information as signals about the cognitive system, but the content of the verbal reports is not accurate. So one sort of case that in with that structure involves metacognitive probes. In many experimental contexts, subjects are asked for meta reports, whether they guessed on a given trial or how confident they are in the response on a given trial, whether they just knew the answer or remembered it. So for example, there's an episodic to semantic shift in our representation of material that we learn. Frequently, when we first learn some material, it's associated richly with the details of the context in which it's learned. But as time passes, it's encoded in a more, in the form of semantic memory, as it's sometimes called, a fact-based memory. Early on, after subjects have just learned some new information, they will say that they remember it. If they report, they're asked questions about the information maybe a week after they've learned it. And then they're asked the meta question. Was your response based on memory, or did you just know? And in the early period after learning, subjects will say they remember the answer. They prefer that way of describing the process. But as time passes, subjects shift with regard to the very same facts. When they are asked about these facts, and then they're asked how they access the facts or about the process of producing them, they will say that they just know, rather than saying they remembered it. And that's interesting because those two verbal responses from subjects, they statistically correlate with the time period and the stage of processing that the information is in. But the answer, just know, isn't very helpful. It doesn't describe much about the cognitive process. It doesn't tell you that what's gone wrong. It's not a matter of having some direct insight into the answer or something. It's a matter of having lost the episodic detail representing the context in which the material was first learned. So in some cases, these kinds of answers are correlated with the use of one subconscious process, problem-solving procedure, rather than another, but without the judgment accurately describing that process or procedure. The meta-judgment, I guessed, for example, might be correlated with the use of one strategy rather than another, even though neither of the strategies in question involves guessing. So there are some sort of famous cases. Maybe this is something that's more likely to resonate with you all. Some famous cases of people who have experienced trauma and they cannot report verbally what's happened in their visual field. But in forced choice experiments, when they're sort of forced to say what they're seeing or what's in front of them, they will get they will respond above chance. They'll give the correct responses above chance, but they claim just to be guessing. So they have damage to visual cortex And so if you hold up a, you know, a card in front of them with a red square and say, you know, what are you seeing? They'll just say, I don't know, I can't see anything. But if they're forced to choose between square and circle, they will say square more often than not, a significantly higher rate than chance. But when they're asked the meta question, they will say, I don't know, I just guessed. So this is not necessarily an example of information carrying by that response, but it's a kind of example that you may be familiar with. These experiments made a big splash when they came out. Sort of like seeing without being able to know that you're seeing. And so you think you're guessing. So there's a kind of mismatch between the report and the process. All right, what a little more about this mere indication, kind of big picture, beyond fundamental physics, and perhaps even in fundamental physics, patterns in the universe consist of probabilistic relations between event types. So if we are to fit self-knowledge into the natural world, we should work within a framework that allows self-knowledge to consist in probabilistic relations between event types. This is a broader picture that stands behind my approach. So even when it comes to philosophical inquiry into other forms of knowledge, not necessarily self-knowledge, I think we should take this approach with us. The philosophers should not insist that knowledge takes the form of truth-apt states, like belief states. And one way to redirect the conversation kind of fruitfully, I think, is to ask about the purpose of self-knowledge. And central to the idea of self-knowledge, it's not all there is to the idea of self-knowledge, but one of the central aspects of the idea of self-knowledge is the idea that something constructive can be done with it. One purpose is to gain greater understanding of ourselves. But the value of that understanding is partly instrumental, that is useful for further ends. Self-improvement, self-modification play a central role in this regard, whether this work is carried out by the individual alone or with help from a medical or mental health professional, or friends or family or anyone. So it's a matter of, can be anything from improving one's ability to get along with other people. I want to stop fighting with my spouse, for example, or you could improve your skill of playing soccer or football, you know, all kinds of possibility ways in which one could improve. Now, I think self-improvement can be achieved by a kind of coordination or coherence. So in the remainder of today's lecture, I focus on the way in which coordination of different parts of the cognitive system can enhance performance or effectiveness. And this is in the spirit of Lecture 5's discussion of the massively representational mind. It's very much in the spirit of the flattened architecture I described. So we have a mess of resources that can all be drawn upon when we're modeling behavioral data. And in that mess of resources, we have multiple representations of the same things, and more effective performance can arise from the contribution of multiple representations of the same environmental features, for example, or the same things in some other way. So this is, in a way, an application of these broader themes, flattened architecture, massively representational mind, to this particular question about self-knowledge and its use in self-improvement. I say it's by achieving coordination between different components of the cognitive system. And just repeating myself there. So let's move on to dual processing models. A distinction is often drawn between processing that is fast, automatic, associative, relatively effortless, and that places little demand on working memory. And this is typically subconscious, I should add. This is often referred to as system one processing, sometimes as implicit cognition. In contrast, there's processing that's slow, deliberative, serial, rule-governed, effortful, and conscious, and that makes heavy demands on working memory. Dual systems or dual processing models were, I think, largely inspired by the dual stream view of visual processing that I talked about earlier in the lectures, with a ventral stream for explicit labeling, object recognition, and a dorsal stream for managing one's physical interaction with the environment. Regardless of the precise history, the idea is that this approach to modeling flourished throughout the 90s and on into the new millennium. In the cognitive sciences, there were dual processing models of all sorts of things, in some cases, triple processing models, as I talked about last Friday in discussing the massively representational mind. But there are some caveats. This talk of system one versus system two has been widely criticized. The various dimensions, automaticity, that it's association-based and so on, they don't line up neatly. They're when you look at individual processes, when you look at models of particular sets of data, you don't see a really clear difference between two clusters of contributors. Often you have some correlation between some factors, but not others. Nevertheless, I'll say, we can ask about various of these dimensions individually and in cases in which they are co-present. So they're still interesting dimensions. So it turns out, like with regard to automaticity, some cognitive processes are initiated automatically, but can be stopped intentionally by conscious intention to stop them. So there are two different dimensions to automaticity, and they don't always go together. And so, but these are dimensions that are very interesting. And with regard to any particular kind of cognitive process, we can ask which of these dimensions are present. Are they some of those system two, so to speak, dimensions? Or are they some of the supposed system one dimensions? And so we can use some of these dimensions to characterize systems, whether or not there's a neat and tidy division of all of our systems into either system one or system two. So what to do? I'll proceed as if there is a robust enough distinction. I think it will work just fine to illustrate the themes that I'm promoting or proposing, right? To put them in terms of system one and system two. I will use this language throughout. And as I mentioned, one really straightforward way to try kind of to understand this quickly and easily is to think of system one as subconscious and system two as conscious. There may be, maybe the most obvious divergences between factors in individual cases is that what we can report verbally without time constraint differs from how we behave under time pressure and what we experience consciously and what is subconscious. So think about those kinds of distinctions when we think of system one, system two, as I proceed through the remainder of the lecture. So what we verbally report on reflection or without time constraint, typically also what we have conscious access to, think of that as system two. How we behave sort of automatically under time pressure, what we is more like the subconscious. The lining up those two with system one is a little bit more complex. Ultimately, the point though is that there are different tendencies among different subnetworks, different processes at work in the production of different forms of behavior. And the behavior of such functional networks can be modified by activity of other networks having different tendencies. It's this last thing that I'm on about. It doesn't matter so much what we call these networks or whether we try to come up with a taxonomy for different kinds of networks. What matters is that there are functional networks with certain tendencies, maybe to produce verbal output, that other networks don't have. By networks, I mean sort of collections of mechanisms that are working together in this particular context to produce a particular kind of behavior. So one network may have certain tendencies, another network may have different tendencies, and they can modify, one can modify the other, or maybe they can modify each other. And that's the kind of situation that can bring different parts of the cognitive system into coordination. So what's this self-coordination all about? Well, one kind of self-knowledge obtains when system two and system one are in kind of real-time coordination with each other. When, for example, the self-representations in system two that produce accurate verbal report on what's producing behavior match in content the representations in system one producing behavioral output. Okay, that's a complex sentence. Let me try to get this again. So here's a kind of case when system two and system one might be in real-time coordination with each other. System two produces self-representations that accurately report on what's producing behavior, and they match the content of the representations in system one producing the behavioral output. So I have a verbal report that says, I'm solving this problem right now by attending to features X, Y, and Z. And in fact, system one is solving the problem by attending to features X, Y, and Z. Because in real-time behavior, system one, automatic, quick, is guiding the behavior to a great extent. So one example here comes from the history of cognitive psychology, the psychology and expertise. So Herb Simon was a big proponent of this. Others, Kyan Glasser, they used problem-solving protocols. Simon did some famous work with Erickson here. And the idea is that having subjects report on their problem-solving process as they're engaging in the problem-solving, it can be very useful. It can provide information. So one kind of experimental design that's been of use in the study of expertise, for example, the solving of problems in math or physics, has been the collection of real-time verbal protocols where subjects report on their thought process as they're solving problems. Although much of the process of working a problem on paper occurs in system one, it's pattern recognition, for example, it's an association of different patterns. System two can simultaneously produce reports on that process. And in some of these experimental settings, those reports have been accurate or they track at least some of what's going on in system one as independently measured. So coordination as self-knowledge, following on. This counts as self-knowledge in my protocol case because each stream carries information about the content of the representations in the other stream. Anyway, this clearly applies to the representations in system two in the kind of case I was imagining in the protocol cases, because the representations in system two accurately represent some of what's occurring in system one. In that way, they fit a fairly traditional notion of self-knowledge as accurate verbal report on the processes that produce one's actions. What about in the reverse direction? Are the representations active in system one, so to speak, fast, immediate, automatic pattern recognition in solving the math problem? Are those processes carrying information about system two? It's maybe more controversial, but it's plausible that some of the representations or processes in system one could be used to predict what verbal reports will be produced by system two. In this case, one can think of the verbal reports, perhaps together with the behavioral output, as carrying information about the representations active in system two. Now, I don't know that this is really all that controversial insofar as, you know, people are willing to do statistical analysis of various data. One can find these dependence relations where the activity of representations in system two can be predicted from the statistical sense from the representations in system one. Now, system two's activity, whether it's accurately representing what's going on in system one or not, can give system role the system two the role as a tutor. So activity in system two can help to make system one's processing sharper and more efficient, both by active guiding and by giving after the fact tutelage. For instance, when successful behavior occurs, system two can explicitly represent success. And this provides the opportunity for language-based rehearsal of system two representations of the behavior-producing processes in system one that led to that behavior, and thus can reinforce whatever system one process was carried out. States in system two can also play this kind of mere information carrying role about what's happening in system one. And they can do it, they carry information. They can do it either by encoding merely correlational information, regardless of whether the states in question have accurate content, or by encoding accurate content. And system two's doing so provides a salutary nudge to system one processing, for instance, to system one processing. For instance, by engaging a filter in the mathematical sense that sharpens signals internal to system one processing, thereby improving the efficiency or effectiveness of the relevant system one processing. So you can think of this as directing attention to certain features of the visual environment or problem-solving environment, actually telling system one to turn up the values on any parameters that are directing attention to those features, so as to make them pop out or to make them more salient, which then will allow for efficiency. Consider an example of the former case. That was the case where the encoding in system two is not of a proposition that accurately describes system one processes. In which self-improvement results from system two's ability merely to carry information about what's happening in system one, regardless of whether the system two structures in question encode propositions about occurrences in system one, or whether those encodings, if they do have truth evaluable content, are accurate. This is more like a mere signaling case. System two might help to improve musical performance by producing, we might think of as encouraging verbalization. Things like, that's right, excellent, or uh-huh, right, in response to what it represents as especially well-constructed musical phrases. This is a kind of a stereotype in, say, jazz music, improvisational jazz, where the, piano player is playing the piano extemporaneously along with a jazz piece, and is sort of vocalizing while doing it, like, yeah, right on, you can think of this as a kind of training signal. Now, in order to do this effectively, for this not just to be an expression of joy, but something that actually has a reinforcing power, right, in a way that improves the playing of the instrument, the differences between the cases in which system two produces uh-huh, or excellent, or right on, right, and the cases in which it produces contrasting output, like, doh, negative output. These must track, though not necessarily perfectly, differences between system one processes that produce especially well-constructed musical phrases and system one processes that do not. It's not sort of merely generic self-encouragement. Now, one way to do that tracking is just to hear the phrases. System two can consciously experience that some phrases are better constructed. And this doesn't have to be improvisational jazz. This can be highly structured symphonic context where phrasing counts. It's not just a matter of playing the notes in the score. One must play them with expression, example. So this sensitivity of system two to the difference between the processes producing musical phrases, better ones and not so great ones, this can be achieved not only by hearing and representing the output by the musical phrase produced, but also by exploiting an internal signal that tracks something like the smoothness or fluidity of the system one process itself. In such cases, system two can provide self-encouragement at the right time based on self-knowledge, but it is not necessarily by explicit representation in system two of the features of system one processes by virtue of which it is smooth or fluid. That is, the signal from system one of fluidity or smoothness is correlated itself within system one, is correlated with certain maybe complicated processes of giving motor commands. If one's playing the piano, motor commands to one's fingers, perhaps, and the rest of the body that's moving in time with the music. There are these detailed processes that are occurring in system one, right? But what system two might pick up on is just a kind of correlated signal, a signal in system one that there's not as much deviation from some quantity, right? We'd have to do the mathematical modeling and find a term like a noise term, for example, or decoherence term or something, right? That could be maybe summarized by a single firing rate, which system two then could be sensitive to. And note too that such signals can be nested. Variation in a higher order signal in system two might carry the information that system two is now in a state of the sort such that when in the recent past, a state of that sort issued in a training signal, that signal was highly effective, measured by performance on immediately subsequent actions, right? The quality of immediately subsequent performances. So the idea is that system two will amplify its own training signal that it sends to system one in these kinds of cases. That is, system two can track its own kind of past performance record. If I'm picking up on a signal from system one that the process of producing this musical phrase was particularly fluid and smooth, and so I send a strong reinforcement signal, training signal, then that might produce effective results. The next phrase is especially good, or the average quality of some number of phrases that follow seems to be raised. Right? Then I might keep a record of this in system two, and thereby kind of be more confident. By that, I mean add a stronger, increase the strength of training signals in similar kinds of situations. I'll trust what I'm getting from system one as a signal of fluidity. I'll trust that as a signal of fluidity and that as an indicator of a good process being carried out in system one. There's lots of room here for feedback loops. It might be that when I say system one keeps a record, system one relies on some system, sorry, system two keeps a record. It might rely on some system one processes to encode that record and provide knowledge, some signals to system two of when it's in a good situation to be giving feedback. So there can be interplay between the two, quite subtle interplay. But this signal I've been describing can be thought of as a metacognitive system, a system of sort, a level of confidence in system two's inclination to send in situations such as the present one as feedback to system one, which thereby manifests itself in a more robust reinforcement of system one's processing than it would have otherwise. And now, I talked at some length about this musical example to try to get across this idea of vehicles coming from system two that play a reinforcing role by carrying self-knowledge, by carrying information about system one, without really expressing any propositions. If I just simply go, or excellent, right? I haven't said anything that's itself truth evaluable. It doesn't make any specific claim about what's going on in system one that helped to produce the musical behavior. Right? But I want to go to the other extreme now and talk about cases where explicit self-knowledge, system two explicitly represents facts about how it works, how the cognitive system works. And the really extreme case might be in theory acquisition. Consider a subject who exists at the end of cognitive scientific inquiry, who has mastered all there is to know about cognitive science. in effect, knows everything about her own cognitive processes. She moves through her life running through a series of system two states that explicitly represent and accurately describe the system one processes she simultaneously executes, exhibiting a kind of perfect coordination between system one and system two. Such system two representations of the activities in system one would be justified by the doing of good science, the doing of which itself requires coordination between system one activities in experimental design, execution, interpretation of experiments, and system two activities, maybe explicit aspects of scientific reason, when one has to apply a consciously endorsed rule to some step in a math problem in calculating a certain kind of statistical significance, for example. So in this case, you've got kind of self-knowledge by doing perfect science, the science of the self. This could also lead to an interesting case where even if one acquires a theory that isn't perfectly accurate, one could enforce coordination and in a way make that theory accurate. In such a case, it's also possible that system two enforces coordination between the two processes. This may be a top-down effect of one's coming to believe certain theories about system one, the belief in which causes system one to be more likely to operate in a way that satisfies those beliefs, entrained, as it were, by the system two structures with which it interacts. So some of you may be familiar with the idea of labeling theory in social psychology or developmental psychology. Sometimes it's discussed in education. If you tell a student that they're smart, if you treat them as if they're smart and capable, then the idea is that they will become more smart and capable, that the labeling itself will create the situation so labeled. It's a kind of a sometimes called a self-fulfilling prophecy. Something like that can happen. As an effect of such beliefs, system two's activity can remove internal discord by helping to make it the case by causal influence on system one that those beliefs come true. So I've been talking about beliefs about the workings of system one. Of course, if a subject existed at the end of cognitive scientific inquiry and knew all of cognitive science, that those theories would apply to system two as well. But I'm interested in coordination. So I'm particularly interested in how those theories would apply to system one and how, when they're explicitly represented in system two, this will reflect coordination or, on the current slide, enforce coordination, create coordination by changing system one. Maybe by creating templates that system one's activities then get sort of pushed into, shaped by. Okay, a reminder of this connection to the massively representational mind. The preceding emphasizes the role of self-knowledge in bringing about a certain kind of self-improvement. Self-improvement by coordinating different subsystems, which leads to more effective behavior. This makes a special sense in the context of the massively representational mind. Remember, the core claim about the massively representational mind is that the quantity of co-referring representations that are contributing to the performance is a predictive quantity. The more co-referring representations contributing, the more likely the behavior is to be accurate, smooth, effective, skillful, et cetera. Okay, so one might reasonably expect then that the effect of such coordination would be to bring the effects of co-referring representations into alignment with each other so as to make their joint contributions to action more effective. This is a hypothesis worth exploring. So I should say there's a fair amount of, you know, various forms of experimental research inspiring the ideas in this talk. But it is largely theoretical cognitive science of the sort that's meant to inspire further work or give shape to existing work, help with the interpretation of it. So at this point, I'm promoting a certain view. How much of these processes actually occur, how important they are, is a matter for further empirical research. but they're not entirely speculative, and that they emerge from an awareness of a lot of what's out there already. All right. So let's think about a different case. Let's flip things around and think about system one as the teacher, as the tutor. How might that work? Let's consider a recent proposal from the Harvard psychologist Fiery Cushman. It was published in 2019 in Behavioral and Brain Sciences. Cushman says he identifies what I'm calling system one processing as non-rational processing. This is processing that's been sort of trained up, habituated slowly by interacting with the world, or is conferred on us by the product of evolution. It's not sort of consciously arrived at conclusions based on explicit reasoning. System two, he says, sorry, I have to hide the window. Didn't mean to do that. System two, might look at behavior that's been produced after the fact and construct a rationalization. An action might have been driven by system one, but after the fact, a rationalization, as it's often called, has been produced. Rationalizations appeal to beliefs and desires. They're reasons-based explanations of behavior. System two then records that belief-desire pair, treating it as a successful way of producing behavior, and can come to use it as the actual basis for action in the future. Excuse me. So the idea is that system one is pretty good at doing certain things all on its own, not by using explicit reasoning, not by using linguistically structured cognition necessarily. Maybe it's using maps and associations and all kinds of subconscious causal processes that don't fit the model of explicit conscious reasoning. Right? But system two, after the fact, can see the success of system one driven performance and can kind of force it into the mold of a rationalization and then record that rationalization and now have a new recipe for action in future cases. Maybe a more flexible recipe is one thing Cushman emphasizes. Maybe evolution is good at producing adaptive action in a very specific kind of context. A rationalization that's built up after the fact about how that behavior was supposedly produced might then be effective in guiding action across a wider range of contexts, Cushman argues. So let's look at an example. Imagine you have a boss who becomes resistant and angry if he or she thinks their authority is being challenged. Yet you would like the boss to do some aspect of their job more effectively, say to send out meeting agendas in a more timely fashion. So this is a boss who schedules meetings. Everyone in the office is supposed to meet. Everyone on the team is supposed to meet. But the boss doesn't send out an agenda until 10 minutes before the meeting. And so the other attendees of the meeting haven't had time to think about the agenda item, maybe brainstorm, develop some informed views, et cetera. And you think that the whole task of the group could be done more effectively if meeting agendas were sent out in a more timely fashion. But you've got this thin-skinned boss, this very sensitive boss who doesn't want to be angry or challenged. Now, evolution may have conferred on us, evolution may have conferred on us a complex set of subconscious system one resources that allow us to engage in social interaction skillfully. For example, by representing the status and personality traits of a conspecific in the social group and tailoring one's emotional valence and choice of words to the situation so determined, allowing one to achieve the outcome one wants. So this seems plausible in some ways because we have so much evidence of sort of pack behavior in a variety of species, hierarchical structured behavior in packs in various species where you have a dominant female or an alpha male, and you have a certain kind of pecking order, and the animals in the group, if it's a group of coyotes or wolves or something, or if it's a group of monkeys, primates and some other, say I think of where you see most of this behavior. Chimpanzees, I think, have a fairly complex social structure. So these kind of complex social structures in animals seem to be based largely on hierarchies and status. And so you think there must be some kind of tools that evolution can give to animals, creatures with brains, for tracking social status. Humans may have inherited this same kind of resource, and it may be contributing usefully during social interaction. In this case with the boss, perhaps it means that because the boss is marked as being high up on the status hierarchy, there is extra sensitivity to negative possible responses. And so extra attention is paid by system one processes to the selection of words. And in this particular case, the result is that the emotional valence that you use when you talk to the boss is very low-key, not hostile, not confrontational, right? And the particular wording that gets selected is put in positive terms rather than negative. It's not, you never send out the agenda on time. It's more like, I'm a slow thinker. It takes me time to consider possibilities. And boy, it sure would help me to have the agenda farther in advance, or something like that. But after the fact, system two might rationalize that behavior by treating the behavior as if it had issued from a belief desire pair. I believed that my boss is sensitive to criticism, and I wanted my boss to raise his or her level of performance by sending out the agendas earlier. So I spoke to my boss in a positive, upbeat, flattering way. Now, it may be that there was no explicit belief that the boss is sensitive to criticism. Maybe you never really thought about it before, whether you had a boss who's, sort of thin skin. But system one was tracking the boss's behavior and had tagged the boss as a sensitive soul or defensive person. And it may be that let's just leave it at that. That belief wasn't present. But after you've formed this kind of story about your past action, it provides a recipe for behavior that can be used across a wide range of contexts. On Cushman's view, this rationalization can become an explicit rule or recipe for guiding behavior in the future, even if in the situation in question, system one produced the effective result, not by the activation of propositional representations with the features of beliefs and desires. That is, even if the system one, if system one processes, even if these system one processes that contributed to the original behavior did not have the structure of a belief desire process. Now, I was working on this this material, I suppose, at the same time as Cushman. And when his paper came out and I read it, I realized what I was working on was just a kind of generalized version of what he's saying. I'm not focused specifically on rationalization and belief desire explanations. Right? The general idea is that system one produces a wealth of praiseworthy and impressive products in the domains of art, music, philosophy, sport, reading comprehension, mathematics, for example, by its contribution to creativity and proofs, in conversation, in counseling, scientific experimentation, pattern extraction, and in the moral domain, it comes to moral wisdom. System one is functioning effectively constantly in many domains, in many ways. To the extent that explicit encoding in system two occurs in response to the conscious, deliberate analysis of system one's successes, system one is training system two, regardless of whether that analysis produces a rationalization. Consider a case in which a system is a subject is working algebra problems and solves some of those problems in one way. For example, by factoring both sides of the equation to isolate a common term, and then dividing both sides by that term, and solves other problems in a different way. Those problems that begin in a different form, in a different way. System two notes that the cognitive system as a whole is having success, and that problems of the first sort start out in a certain format, and problems of the latter sort start out in a different format. They see a tell or a cue in the shape of the original question. System two can then feed that now explicitly formulated rule back into the problem solving process, enhancing further the cognitive system's success by higher test scores. System two was taught by system one how to guide system one's activity and the organism's activity, more generally speaking, so that it's more effective. The system one can be the teacher in this kind of case. And let's look at the moral case in particular. Tamar Gendler is a philosopher at Yale. He's affiliated with the cognitive science program there. And Gendler is relatively widely known for proposing that there is a distinction between what she calls A leaf and B leaf. B leaf is, in today's terms, B leaf is a system two affair, while A leaf is a lot like B leaf, but it's a system one affair. It is a separate stream of representation that's more tightly connected to action and emotion, for example, affect. There's a lot of literature showing the effects of what Gendler would call belief A leaf discordance when these two come apart. So she gives the example of subjects who walk out on a very safe, very secure architectural structure that has a glass floor, a see-through floor above a canyon. It's the Grand Canyon in the United States. And some subjects, they explicitly believe that this is perfectly safe to walk out onto this platform. It's very well protected, it's enclosed. nevertheless, their visual experience of the glass floor, of seeing thousands of feet of empty space below them creates anxiety. They are less willing to go out onto the platform. It takes them longer to sort of obey a request, satisfy a request to go out on it. So there's a very interesting research program of Gendler's that seems to put some system one processes, system two processes alongside each other. She doesn't say anything about getting rid of the personal level or flat modeling, but part of my inspiration comes from this incipient idea as it appears in Gendler. But even those who appreciate much of the messiness of cognitive processing, such as Gendler, still sometimes endorse a top-down view of the relationship between so-called system two and system one, treating system two as more trustworthy and placing system two in charge. I think this relates to a long, you know, history of valorizing conscious, explicit reasoning, of kind of really seeing it as the pinnacle of human thought. Gendler applies this in the moral domain. If so, then Aristotle is right, she says. In order to live well, we must work to bring our habits in accord with our reflective beliefs. The reflective beliefs, according to Gendler, are where you find the truth, right? Where we arrive at the truth about morality, and then we must work hard to put ourselves in situations where we will develop habits that will accord with those reflective beliefs, that will reinforce behavior that has the right structure or the right outcomes as represented by, as I would say today, system two. But I think this denies system one its important role as a teacher. It sticks system one back into the slave or subservient role or the student role of being guided. The moral case is no different from the mathematical case of solving algebra problems that I gave a few minutes ago. Observed events in the world engage system one. They engage our natural sympathies. And much of what system two comes to believe emerges from reactions driven by system one. And of course, system two's explicit representations, its beliefs, then can feed back to system one. I have tried to encourage this this view of these two systems as or more systems, right, as interacting with each other and mutually shaping each other to come into coordination, right? But at certain stages, it's system one teaching system two. Consider the widely reported on case of George Floyd. He was a Black American who was killed by the police in Minneapolis, Minnesota, a part of the United States, was killed by police in, I think, May of 2020. A video film was captured by onlookers and it was spread around. And many Americans came to have certain explicitly held beliefs about policing in the United States, that it was morally unjust, it was racially biased, those kinds of things, because of their gut level reactions when watching the video of the killing of George Floyd. In this case, one might argue that System 1 is teaching System 2 about morality, rather than being a situation in which System 2 identifies the moral truth by reason and tries to control System 1 by enforcing those supposed truths. Now, I don't mean to put too much emphasis on the case of George Floyd itself. Maybe there are nuances there that, you know, some people would think I'm not allowing for properly. But I think this represents a broader pattern in the civil rights domain and elsewhere. Black people in America were treated horribly for many, many years. Some would argue that they still are, but I'm saying more horribly. Enslaved and then living under Jim Crow in the early 1900s, for example. And it was largely ignored by white America. One might argue that the greatest kind of impetus that the United States got for the civil rights movement in the 1950s and 1960s was television, was that Americans across the spectrum, white Americans in rural Wisconsin, for example, could now see firsthand sort of what happened when Martin Luther King, for example, marched across a bridge nonviolently with other Black Americans and then just being sort of viciously beaten by police. This visual processing and emotional reactions, they are to a great extent System 1 processes. And it changed the political landscape in the US. It caused many more people to have explicit beliefs about the wrongness of racism and allowed legislation to be passed that had not previously gone anywhere. So System 1 as teacher, I think views like Gendler's that put reason and System 2 in charge are ignoring this very important role of System 1. As teacher. System 1 sometimes gets things wrong. I'm not saying System 1 is perfect at all, we want to recognize its role as a potential teacher. Now, I want to close with some comments about two features that have been especially important in the philosophical literature on self-knowledge. So, what often happens in the philosophy of mind, in this case overlaps with epistemology, is that we have a kind of phenomenon that's recognized by the average person. I seem to know myself better than others, or some people seem to know themselves, have more self-knowledge than others. And we begin to reflect on what's special about the self-knowledge case versus other cases. Some features are then generated. They become desiderata. They become almost like data points, conceptually produced data points that any theory of self-knowledge is supposed to account for. So immediacy is one. It's the idea that whatever your theory of self-knowledge is, it should be immediate. We should be able to somehow just see or tell things about ourselves that other people couldn't tell. And on a related note, another of these desiderata is authority, that we have a kind of self-authority about, in these cases of self-knowledge. We have this immediate awareness, and it gives us a kind of position, a first-person position that confers on us a kind of presumptive authority. If we say something about ourselves, if we think we're in a certain state, then kind of no one else is in a position to challenge this, the traditional idea that there's privileged first person authority. Now, given the flattened architecture and massively representational mind and all these cognitive scientific departure from armchair philosophy, one might wonder whether what I've been talking about can come anywhere close to delivering what philosophers thinking from the armchair have wanted: immediacy and authority, for example. To the extent that the sort of learning and real-time guidance or correction I've described cannot be achieved easily by any process other than an internal one, the picture on offer delivers a kind of causal immediacy and self-regulative first-person authority. In virtue of the reliability of internal causal connections, the individual is in a better position than outside parties to effect the sort of coordination I have described. So, think back to one of the examples from earlier in the lecture of musical performance and system two getting signals from system one that system two can use to reinforce kind of good behavior, good processing. So depending on the form of system one processing, I was saying, there may be an indicator that goes along with it that it sends a signal to system two, a signal that system two can track. So what would this kind of signal be? Well, as I mentioned earlier, we'd have to go through kind of the details of the mathematics, but it might be that there's less noise in a smoother system one process. Or there is, less of an average gap between the issuing of the motor command and the proprioceptive confirmation of the execution of the command. Something like that, the average amount of time is shorter and a smoother performance, maybe because it's flowing more fluidly. Right? But some kind of signal like that is picked up by system two to differentiate between cases where reinforcement should be given and cases where it's not. That kind of signal, tracking that kind of signal, is not the sort of thing that can be done by others. It's not in a real-time way that allows for feedback. Other people are not sufficiently causally connected to bring about certain of these effects in a timely or effective fashion. Other sources aren't wired up so as to detect or respond to the kind of internal activities in question. Now, that doesn't mean they couldn't possibly be wired up. You might imagine a case where the neuroimaging technology has become so good and our understanding of the way in which system two communicates with system one is advanced so far that from an external perspective, kind of neuroscientists could do the job. Neuroscientists could know when a system one process producing musical performance is smooth, when it's fluid, and when it's clunky by measuring these kinds of quantities I've suggested, average time between the issuing of a motor command and its proprioceptive confirmation or something like that. That could be picked up on by an external party doing neuroimaging. And then if that external party also knew how to send reinforcement signals, could do just as good a job as the individual could. But as this stands, it's science fiction and maybe not too fictional, not too far out in our future. But the point is there is a natural basis here for the ideas of immediacy and authority. A first-person authority. It's not absolute. Philosophers who think there's something very special about, conscious reflection and conscious awareness, and that gives us an immediacy and an authority, and, that just is absolutely tied to the first-person conscious perspective, and no one else could possibly have it. I'm not going to be able to satisfy those philosophers. But there's at least a simulacrum of immediacy and authority in this kind of position. But it's sometimes acknowledged in the self-knowledge literature as a kind of second-rate form of immediacy and authority. I mean, it's acknowledged in its general sense that there might be reliable connections internally that sort of contingently allow for one sort of performance, for certain forms of self-knowledge that will be difficult for anyone else to get about you. But it's worth asking whether, you know, when we really understand the way in which cognitive systems are integrated, it would be interesting to sort of explore this idea of whether integration itself, the way in which cognitive systems are made up of various subsets of mechanisms that contribute overlapping collections, whether this way of making a system an effective system, one that can respond intelligently to the environment, that has built into it as a natural concomitant, has built into it a privilege for the cognitive system in certain kinds of self-regulatory processing, privilege that would just be nearly impossible for even very advanced technology to duplicate. Anyway, I'll leave things there. Get rid of my screen sharing.